Blog Talk Radio.
With Charles Ross and with Dr. Ross here, and today we have an interesting show. We'll be talking about investing in real estate. My guest is going to be Bill Omi. He's a 20-year veteran in real estate. He owns over 45 properties and generates over $200,000 a year in rental income. Good evening, Bill. Are you there?
I'm here, Charles. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. All right. I'm glad this worked out. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show, Bill. And one of your sayings that I did not include is that you say real estate is not about properties, it's about people. You want to kind of explain that a little bit?
Most people focus on real estate thinking it has to do with the bricks and mortar. But really, and we talk about this sometimes when we get together, everybody's a real estate investor. If you live in a house, if you pay rent, if you pay taxes on your property, by default, you're a real estate investor. So real estate's really about the people, because everybody needs real estate. Everybody needs shelter. Everybody needs a roof over their head. You know, I joke, I say, the iPhone, they're not going to come up with an app on an iPhone that renders your need for shelter obsolete. It's not going to happen. You can't live under your iPhone. So it's really about helping people with property problems. That's sort of how we look at it.
So share a little bit how you got involved in real estate. How did you get involved in
it? I got involved, really, I was working the corporate job. I mean, my background is engineering, and I worked for a company. I loved engineering, but I could never figure out how, when I was driving to work, people were on the golf course. You know, I'd be like driving to work, sitting in traffic, and there's people playing golf, having a good time. And I used to think, wow, these people must be so much smarter than me. That's the only thing I could figure out. And then when I started piecing it together, I just realized they had learned a couple different rules than what we're taught in school. And once you realize that, it changes your whole perspective. You know, investors and wealthy people, they don't chase income. They don't look for jobs. What they actually chase is relationships. They know other wealthy people. And they chase knowledge. They chase specified knowledge or specific knowledge that we're not taught in school. You know, we're taught to become members of society, you know, cogs in the wheel, employees working for someone. And wealthy people don't think that way. They think differently. And when I started realizing that, I'm like, oh, this is a whole world. It's like a parallel universe. And most people aren't tuned into that. You know, 99% of the people are in the rat race. They're just chasing more money to pay more taxes, to chase more money. And if they stop working, the money stops coming in. And
now
you've
been investing for 20 years, and you know your perspective is a little different than folks who just got in, perhaps in the last year or two when we've been in a great market. So you went through the 2008 crash. Share a little bit about that and how that has impacted your approach to real estate investing?
Yeah, when I started looking at real estate, the thing that fascinated me, there was two things about real estate that fascinated me. One is that I could buy properties at a discount. I could buy, and if no other asset class, you can do this. And you just create your wealth instantly. It's almost like so simple it's absurd. Just buy the assets at a discount, create your wealth instantly. You don't have to wait for things to go up in value. You just do it right away. And the second thing was, while I'm holding that asset, I can generate tremendous cash flow. Someone will pay me very well to use my asset while I'm holding it. And when I realized those two, it was like, oh, now I know why 90% of the millionaires in the world created their wealth through real estate. It was like, those are the two things. Buy the assets at a discount, and then cash flow. And what happened was, and this is happening now also, you go through the cycles of real estate where everything gets all excited, everybody gets excited, they pump up the prices, and then what happens? The bottom falls out. You know, I mean, look at the crashes. 1987 was the crash, 1994, 2000, 2001, 2008. And now, guess what's happening again? Same thing. It's like history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure rhymes. I think that was a Mark Twain thing. So what you learn is, if you're focused on cash flow, you're impervious to the cycles. So in my world, where I'm buying little houses, and getting extreme cash flow out of them, when the crashes hit, I don't care. Because even if my properties were go to zero, and they never do, because that's just not how things work, as long as the cash flow is coming in, you just don't care. And cash flow pays the bill. You know, equity vanishes overnight, but cash flow can last forever. So if you just focus on cash flow, all of a sudden, real estate investing, it's not as speculative. It's not as drama filled. Wealthy people love cash flow. They don't care about asset values. They care about cash flow. And again, it's just learning these things. And when you learn it, it's like, whoa, this is where I want to be.
So you're basically saying that if you're buying real estate as an investor for cash flow, you're not so much concerned about the value of it. Obviously, if you're going to, get a loan, you have to be concerned about that a little bit, but you don't care about the value fluctuating, because as long as you're getting your rental income from it, then if that's what you're in it for, then you're good. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah. In fact, the reason you don't care about the value is you've already bought it at a huge discount. So in my world, and this is like, it's almost like the Monopoly game. My world, it's, okay, $70,000 houses, I want to buy them for $20,000. And everybody says, that's impossible. It's like, oh, no, that happens every day. And it's just, people don't know what they don't know. So if you're buying $70,000 houses for $20,000, even if we have a cataclysmic crash and your properties get cut in half, so what? So now your $70,000 house is worth $35,000. You only paid $20 for it. You're still making incredible cash flow.
So one of the things that you said that's clear is that you have to make sure that when you buy it, you're buying it, you're making your money when you buy it. In other words, you've got equity in it. You're not buying a $70,000 house for $70,000. You're going to buy it at a discount, so you've got the value already established. And then you start getting your cash flow. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Investors buy at deep discounts, okay? If you can't get it at a deep discount, don't buy it. It's that simple. See, real estate, like stocks and bonds, you can't buy a stock at a discount. If Microsoft trades at $100 a share today, you're going to pay $100. And then you're going to hope and pray that it's going to go up in value. You have no control. Whereas in real estate, you can buy the asset at a huge discount. You can create your wealth instantly. You can create your rate of return on day one. So again, if you're buying that $70,000 house for $20,000, you just made, I don't know, 350% on your money. You created the wealth instantly. It's almost like it's a joke. It's so easy.
So right. Now, you started out 20 years ago, and I'm sure you've had, you know, some bumps and bruises along the way. What's the most valuable lesson that you learned, you know, when you first started out? Because I remember when you told me you first started out, you bought all these books by these different gurus and stuff like that about how to buy with no money down and all that. So what was some of the experiences that you had that made you such a, because now you own, what, 45 properties? You might be up to 50 by now, you know.
Yeah, 40-something.
Okay, you lost track. Okay. So explain some of the, because people think that if you go into real estate, immediately you have to, you know, hit it out the park. And, you know, we know that's not true. So explain a little bit about, give me an example of a great success and then something where, wow, I wish I didn't do that.
I'll tell you, and actually it's a perfect timing for that. The fear of missing out, okay, when the market's near its top, everybody's getting into real estate. So, I mean, we're talking about 2 months ago. So 2 months ago, before there was a coronavirus, it was tough to buy properties at a discount. Because, as I would say, the dumb money, and I say that affectionately, but people that had more money than education were just throwing money at deals. They would pay anything for a property. And so that would make it very difficult to buy properties at a discount because you're competing against people that just don't care. Okay? But that's the most dangerous time for investors because you start to bend the rules. You know, if cash flow is everything, if buying assets at a huge discount and cash flowing them is the goal, you start making excuses. Well, it's okay if I pay a little more for this because, look, the market's going up. Or it's okay if I pay a little more for this property because Walmart's moving next door and everybody knows that, you know, that you're going to make more money. That is, you know, it's different this time. Those words have sunk more investors than anything I can think of. When you start lying to yourself, when you start making excuses because you're not finding good deals, that's when you start losing money. It's just, you know, I remember, because I was telling a friend the other day, I said, you know, just before this virus thing hit, I said, it feels just like 2007, man. Everybody's a real estate genius. Everybody wants to be in the stock market. Everybody is making money. Everybody's, as I said, a genius. And there's a saying in the business, is don't confuse a bull market with genius. Right? It's
so
not different this time.
So what's been a good deal for you? Give us a time. I know you're saying 70. What's it been? Give us an example of a deal that you did and say, wow, this is a great deal. And
oh.
One that, you know, like say, hey, this, I wish I didn't do that, you know.
Well, the wish I didn't do that is overpaying for the properties that don't have the cash flow. It's, again, making excuses and saying, well, I really only should pay $30,000 for this house. But you know what? I can pay $40,000 because it's in a good neighborhood. And it's like, well, will anybody pay you any extra money because of that excuse? It's like, well, no. Then, see, you're buying numbers. You don't buy properties. And here's another thing that people do. Novices, they buy, especially in, like, rentals, they'll buy properties that they project themselves living. They don't pay attention to the customer who's actually going to be living in the house, create value for them. They start looking at it through their prism, through their perspective. And you've got to understand your job is to provide value for your customer, not for yourself. And that's a whole discussion you could have. But I'll give you examples. There's probably like 13 ways to buy properties at a huge discount. I love tax deeds. I love buying properties that somebody's not paying the taxes on, and the county auctions it off because they need their tax money. And, you know, I bought a $50,000 house for $1,500. That's almost free, right?
And so you did that here in Georgia.
I don't know what it is. It's 3 or 4% of market value. I mean, it's amazing.
So
it's like buying Microsoft stock for $3. If you could do that, you can back up the truck.
So if why would somebody that has a house valued at $50,000, why would they, you know, not pay the taxes? That's only a couple of thousand dollars. What scenario creates a situation where you could buy that?
Well, I'll give you an example, and this is classic. Estates. So a lot of times people die and they don't have a will. So they might own a piece of property, and maybe they got kids or relatives that are living with them, and they die, and the kids or the relatives are living in the property, but they don't have a will, so they don't probate it. So they don't know who the owner is, right? The owner is a dead person. And then maybe the taxes come due, and the people living in the house, maybe they have problems. Maybe they're divorced. Maybe they have drug problems. You know, the world is full of drama. And nobody wants to pay the taxes. Maybe they fight with each other. And so now nobody's paying the taxes. The county guys have to get their money. They need their money to pay the firemen and the teachers and all that. The county doesn't care about the drama. The county says either you pay the taxes or we auction it off to somebody who will. And you'd be surprised how many times and this is across the nation, it'll be in a state. Divorce. People getting divorced, they may not give a care about that property. That, you know, there's an emotional component in divorce. Or it may be, hey, I want to get back at the other guy or gal, and I'll sell the thing, you know, for a song. Incarceration. I've had a person who lost a property or sold it at a huge discount because they had legal problems and they needed the money for their lawyer. They weren't so interested in the property. They were interested in staying out of jail, right? Bankruptcy. People who've got to take a job someplace. Maybe, like, look at the situation now. People lose jobs like now. There's going to be a huge wave of foreclosures in 3 to 6 months. People don't have jobs. How are they going to pay their mortgage? They can't, you know, they're trying to just put food on the table. So in these situations, there's opportunity. And again, the opportunity is you didn't create the problem. You're there to solve it as best you can. Okay? A lot of times the property will get taken back by the county or taken back by the bank. And then they have to get rid of it. The bank, let's say the bank has to get rid of it. That's called an REO. Well, banks don't want to be in the property management business. So if you understand how to create value for banks, they'll sell you properties for pennies on the dollar. But again, you've got to learn these things.
It seems like there's so many ways to skin the cat in terms of real estate investing. Is it advisable, you know, to figure out a strategy and then stay with that strategy? Like, you know, you do tax deeds, you do a lot of different things. But when you're first starting out, is it wise to just say, I'm going to, you know, just concentrate on, you know, rental properties? Am I going to do fix and flips? I'm going to buy properties using tax liens and tax deeds and those kind of things? Or just to be all over the place? Because I'm thinking that you have to get some education in order to do some of this stuff. And because before you jump in, you don't want to, you know, make some terrible mistakes.
This is huge. Most people, it's amazing. Somebody will watch a YouTube video, and they'll be like, okay, I'm going to be a real estate investor. It's like, well, if you could watch a brain surgery video, you could go be a brain surgery, right? There's a disconnect. So what I always tell people is get educated, get with people, start hanging out with people that are successful. Okay, because you got to learn some stuff, because there's two ways to learn stuff. Either you learn it from people that already know it, or you go through the School of Hard Knocks. And the School of Hard Knocks can be incredibly expensive, right? I mean, just ask all the busted real estate investors in 2008 that, you know, were mortgaging properties to the hills. You know, leverage, 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 doesn't matter, property's going to go up every day, you know, there's always a greater fool to buy my properties, until there wasn't. And they lost it. You know, and then, you know, there's the emotional component, divorces and bankruptcies and busted relationships, and, oh my God, it, you know, suicide, people, you know, it's terrible to lose everything. So
we're going to take a break, and for about 2 minutes, we're going to play a little segment here, and Bill, you're sharing some good stuff. It seems like you're going in and out. I don't know if you're on a landline or a speakerphone, something like that. It's kind of coming in and out, so I want to make sure people can hear. So we're going to take a break for about 2 minutes, and on the other side, we're going to talk about more about real estate and how you should look at getting that first property. We're talking to Bill Omi, a 20-year real estate investor, owns over 40 different properties, and generating income of $200,000. You want to stick around for this. Also, I'm giving away a copy of my book, Your Common Sense Guide to Personal Financial Planning, to the first 5 callers who call in and ask a question of Bill about real estate investing. I know you got to have a question. Our number, 516-387-1554. That's 516-387-1554.
Small businesses face special challenges in controlling their costs. A few simple strategies on today's Your Personal Finance.
A classic story of boy meets girl. Two people at a diner soon discover they share an interest in something other than coffee.
So what do you like best about your Dodge Neon?
Lots of stuff.
Like?
I love the 16-valve single overhead cam.
Excuse me?
Or maybe the electronic fuel injection.
How about the hype sound system?
Or the power windows.
And the power locks.
They're good, but what I really like is Neon's power to turn heads.
How about another cup of coffee?
No, how about a drive?
Now you can drive the head-turning Neon for less than you probably expect. Get one all dressed up with lots of extras, including 15-inch wheels or an alarm system. Dodge Neon. Different. Now at a friendly Dodge dealer near you.
Any small business owner knows profits can bleed out fast in both large and small ways. Saving money has to be the top priority. Here are a few practical suggestions to get you started. First, stay close to your business's finances. Open your own mail so that you know what bills are paid, when one is overdue, and whether complaints are being received. Keep an eye on checks written on the company account. If any employee dishonesty should turn up, you'll spot it. Another tip, don't put on the Ritz too soon. Lavish spending may impress one or two clients, but it can get you into trouble fast. Save money by staying at inexpensive hotels, opting for red-eye flights, and other common-sense economies. Remember, no one is going to look after your business as carefully as you. For Your Personal Finance, I'm Charles Ross.
And we're back, Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross. Joining me via phone is Bill Omi. We're talking about real estate investor, and we do have a caller who has a question. Good evening, caller. It sounds like you're from Savannah with that 912 area code. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. This is Priscilla.
Hey, Priscilla.
Priscilla, how are you?
Hi. Hi, Mr. Omi. Hi, Charles. How are you this evening?
I'm doing mighty fine.
Great.
You have a question for Bill?
My question, yes, I do. I have, like, this real estate kit that I bought, like, maybe 20 years ago because I thought I wanted to go into real estate. And I still am very interested, but I get so afraid to make that first step because I'm always thinking, I get guilty about, am I taking someone's home? Maybe I should just take the money, like you said, the tax deed. You know, maybe I should just find out who owns this house and just give them the money so they can keep their house. That's that's where I am with real estate. I'm always afraid of taking someone's home because I don't want anyone to take my home if I got into financial trouble.
So your concern.
So what do you think, Bill?
So your concern, Priscilla, is about how the fact that you're going to be a real estate investor might affect somebody. Is that pretty much
right?
What you're
right.
Thinking? Okay.
Or you know, like obtaining my property that I would like.
Sure.
All right,
well,
Bill.
your goal actually is to help people, Priscilla. Okay. Now, remember when you didn't create the circumstances that are causing whatever the problem is. Okay?
Right.
And unless you're a charity, then, you know, just giving somebody money to save their home, inevitably, you know, weeks later, the same thing's going to happen. Okay? So the goal here is, and I'll give you just foreclosures. Okay, you're going to lose this property because you didn't pay your mortgage. And I'll tell you, when you talk to people, a lot of times you can make suggestions to them. When I talk to people about their situations, if there's a way for them to save their house, let's say they can do a short sale, or they can do, well, short sale they wouldn't save it, but let's say they could do a loan modification. I'll definitely say, listen, get with your bank and talk to them about a loan modification. That may be your way to save the house. Okay, so I'm always looking, if there's a way for them to save the property and I can give them that information, I'm okay with that. Because there's a concept of karma, right?
Right.
You want it to pay it forward and make sure that you're adding value as you go along. But it comes down to, you know, sometimes you run out of options. And here's an example would be, a loan mod where the person doesn't have a job. So even if they get a loan mod, they can't make payments. So the loan mod is destined for failure. Okay? So now
that's
the question
right.
is, well, what do you want to do, Mr. Homeowner or Ms. Homeowner? Do you have a plan? And if they have a plan, hey, maybe there's a way I can help you. You know, here's a loan officer. Here's a credit repair company. All that stuff is good. But if there's not, let's go down the list. What can you do? Okay? And here's the thing about help. If you bail somebody out and you buy their property, let's say, before it goes into foreclosure, their credit doesn't get as dinged up. Right? If you go through a foreclosure, your credit's pretty busted. You're going to be down and out for many years.
Right.
But if the person sells the property, then maybe they just had a 90-day late on their credit. So it might be something that in a month or two, they're eligible to get back into the loan programs to buy a house. So you've saved them that drastic crashing of their credit. And there's value in that. Okay?
Okay.
So all of this comes down to, hey, is there a way to create value for the seller and for yourself given a set of circumstances? I'm not the person that goes in and created these circumstances. I'm the person trying to craft a solution in what might be a bad problem right now.
Okay.
Did that help you, Priscilla?
It did, yes. It certainly did. Thank you so much, Bill. Thank
sure.
you, Charles.
Yeah, and send me your address at charlesross@outlook.com, and I'll get that book out to you tomorrow.
Great. I'll read that.
All right. Thank you so much,
Thank
Priscilla.
Thank you.
All righty. Take care.
All right.
Good.
Bye-bye.
You know, Bill, one of the things that that you do that I want you to share with listeners is that you help the folks that are renting houses from you become homeowners. Explain that value proposition you give to some of your renters in order to own the property that they're currently living in.
Oh, yeah, this is another way to create value. All my tenants, I look for tenants that don't want to rent, that actually aspire to owning a property. And the reason is I get incredibly good tenants. You know, a lot of people have heard horror stories of tenants ripping up your houses and not paying the rent. And that actually is on the landlord's responsibility. They're not creating much value. They're just providing shelter. And shelter is a commodity. But if you give people a pathway to not only rent a property, but to own it, that changes the value relationship tremendously. And a lot of times, it makes you more money. Like, and because what you're doing is you're creating value that both people get to monetize. People think it's a zero-sum game. If I help somebody, then I'm taking something away from me. Value creation is infinite. So through your knowledge and through your relationships, if you can learn to create value, there's no limit to what you can create. And once you start realizing that, the investing becomes a lot of fun because that's almost like a puzzle. And you get smarter and smarter, and you just learn to create more and more value, and other people get to benefit from it. So, yeah, so all my tenants, and I'll give you a statistic for your audience. 80%, it's probably more now, before the crash, 80% of the U.S. population could not get a bank loan. 80%.
Wow.
Now it's probably 95%. Do you know what an opportunity that is for you as an investor to create value? The vast majority of the U.S. population has no access to the banking system. You get to be a bank. And guys, that's the highest profitability business in the planet. Banks are the most profitable entities on the planet. If you can become a bank, that's your goal. That's what you want to be.
So you're basically saying that I'm assuming that all of your tenants are in that situation, but how do you select your tenants? I mean, how do you vet them to make sure you don't get somebody who's going to sign a lease for a year and then skip out in 3 or 4 months?
Well, there's processes. I mean, you can have a property manager who vets out tenants. Usually what you want is you want some sort of an application that's consistent. And I would suggest if anybody's going to get into the rental business, use a property manager for your first rentals because they know the laws, they know the rules. You know, there's a lot of intricacies of having tenants, and it's nice if you have a property manager. I work with a group. We actually had a class on how to manage property managers because that's another issue of value. Is your property manager an asset that's creating value for you, or are they an expense? Most people would think a property manager is just an expense. Well, it depends on that relationship. It depends on how you work with that property manager, whether they're adding value or just costing you an expense.
And that's a good thing. One of the things I hear, Bill, is when I talk to people and, you know, I tell them I'm a real estate investor, and they say, oh, I did that. I didn't like it. You know, I was getting calls at 3 a.m. about the toilet being overflown. I said, well, that's one of the reasons that with the real estate that we own, that Felicia and I own, that we have a property manager because we don't want to get a call at 3 a.m. First of all, I'm not good at doing stuff like that. But second, I don't want to get a call that I have to come repair something or fix something. You know, I want somebody boots on the ground, and you know, our real estate is, you know, about an hour and a half, you know, away from Atlanta. So getting down there is going to take a couple hours to get down there. And so that's one of the things I hear about folks that were former real estate investors that they had. And generally, here's the other thing I hear. They only owned one or two properties. To me, if you're going to get into it, then you got to get into it, you know, because you just get into it and say, I'm just going to own one or two properties. What's your strategy? You're just going to have two properties and that's it? Hopefully, you're doing this so that you can not have to work anymore. I don't want a job, you know, where I have to get up and go to work. Do you hear that to be the case where folks that when you tell them you're a real estate investor and then they give you this story about they owned one property and it was a nightmare?
Oh, yeah. I hear that all the time, right? Oh, I was doing that. Man, I couldn't stand it anymore. It was a nightmare. You know, my tenants trashed my house. They didn't pay the rent. Blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's a caricature that – and again – It's more because people, they're not educated. They don't really know what the business is. They just own the property that they rented out, right? There's a huge difference between being a real estate investor and just owning a property that you rent out. A lot of people end up being what's called a haphazard landlord, where let's say they move into a new house, but they can't sell their old house, so they rent it out. Ouch, right? That's not business. I don't know what that is. That's misery. okay? So, you know, you've got to make sure that you're in a business rather than, I don't know, a hobby, something. I don't even know what to call it, okay? So that's part of it, is understanding how the business works, understanding what you're trying to do, and then the learning how to create all that value, right? That once you have that down, life becomes a lot easier. And it, listen, for a lot of people, they shouldn't be in real estate investing. They should put their money in the stock market, hope that the guys on Wall Street are going to take care of them, and if they end up broke, you know, when they're 80 years old, believe me, Goldman Sachs is not going to say they're sorry. You know, so you're not going to get a sorry letter if you don't have any money when the Wall Street guys, you know, crash the market every 10 years.
Our phone number, 516-387-1554. You call in. We already had one caller get a copy of my book, Your Common Sense Guide to Personal Financial Planning. 516-387-1554 to ask Bill Omi a question. One of the things that I think that most people assume that once you start investing in real estate, that you know everything. You know, are you still learning stuff after 20 years, Bill?
Oh, you're constantly learning. I mean, that's, you know, if you're any business or any profession that you're in, it's constantly learning, constantly continuing education. You know, when new things happen, when, like now we have this big dislocation, what is the new real estate market going to look like? Where is the value creation? What models won't work? When we all come out of this lockdown, what models are going to be instantly obsolete? And there will be, you know, and people that only have one, you know, as we call them, the one-trick ponies, if they only have one idea of what to do in real estate, they could get wiped out. They could really take a beating. So it's like you always have to be, you have to have the tools and the knowledge to adjust when the market adjusts. That's really the key. And that's like that in any business. It's amazing. People will spend 4 years in college learning all sorts of things to do what they're doing in their jobs. But then they think they can watch, you know, or get a book or a CD, and they can go out and, you know, move millions of dollars around in real estate investing, and they're frustrated or hurt when it doesn't work out. It's always an interesting thing that I see, is that they won't invest in themselves. They think it's just supposed to happen, you know, organically or magically, I guess.
Now, one of the things that Felicia and I, when we were looking at investing in real estate, and we studied and read it for 2 years, and then we finally, you know, bit the bullet and just went out and bought something after we got educated, is Atlanta. Can you still find good deals in Atlanta? I just found Atlanta to be overpriced for what we were looking for. And I'll share a minute what our, you know, ideal property looks like. So you're investing in the Atlanta area. Is Atlanta just so competitive? There's so many people here that it's hard to find good deals right now?
I would say it's harder in a metro area because you have more competition. But again, if you understand the different ways to create value, if you understand where you can find properties, you can find properties in any area, okay? I mean, but you've got to go, as I say, you've got to go where they ain't. You've got to look at areas that most investors are not looking at. Case in point, like the MLS, the Multiple Listing Service. It's like the most liquid market on the planet. So if you're looking at properties in the MLS, every person in the world can see it, especially with the internet. So it's very difficult to create value or get a deal because there's so many other competitors. And I often, you know, I chuckle when people are like, well, I couldn't find anything on the internet, or the second I found it, it was already bought. It's like, of course! Right? And so of course everybody can see it. But let me give you an example, like we were talking about tax deeds. I've gone to tax deed auctions, and here's the case of Metro Atlanta. You go down to Fulton County on a tax deed or Gwinnett County, and you're going to have lots of competition. I mean, there's lots of investors with deep pockets that are going to compete against you. But you go 30 miles outside of Atlanta in any direction, and you're in a rural area, you may go to a tax auction. There's nobody else there. There's 159 counties in Georgia. They all have auctions. And yet people will look only in the county they live in. And I'm amazed at that. It's like, well, I went down to the auction and there were other people there. Okay, so did you try another county? Oh, I didn't think of that. Oh, well, okay. Right? So, same thing with foreclosure auctions. Same thing.
And you make a good point because, you know, we were looking at tax liens, tax deeds in a county south of Atlanta and went down there and got the listing. And in the process of going through the tax liens and the list of 150 properties, and we went through the list, looked at the ones that we thought we won, narrowed it down to about 30 properties, ended up about 5 properties. And one of the great things about it is that, and Bill, you helped me with this, is that you don't want to go to the tax office. You want to go to these folks who owe $2,000 or $3,000 and say, hey, listen, you know, and this is getting to a little bit into how tax deeds work. Hey, on such and such a date, someone's going to buy your property. Yes, you're going to have a year to stay in the property, but after that year, they're going to own it. Well, hold up. Suppose I give you $1,000 so I can take possession of the property right now. But, of course, you got to know a little bit about the property to be able to do that. But that's part of the putting in the work, you know, because it took us about 2 days. Me and my nephew came down from Lincoln, Nebraska, and we looked at over 2 days about 30 properties, and we settled on about 6 or 7. But now, of course, the thing is we found some other properties, and he found a property that he's going to buy. So you have to put in the work, and I think that's really the key, isn't it? But you got to be willing to put in the work, not only to study, but before Felicia and I bought our first property, I mean, we may have looked at 20, 30 properties before maybe even more than that, because you got to get an idea as to what you like and what you don't like and what's a good deal and what's not a good deal. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So, you know, you're not going to buy the first property that you find, right? The more deals you're looking at, the better the deals you're going to get. And, you know, one thing that most people don't do is a lot of people get educated, but then they don't do the most important thing, which is take action, right?
Right.
I mean, I've had so many people that tell me, well, you know, I tried to do that and I took classes or I watched a video or I went to a 3-day boot camp and, you know, it didn't work for me. And I'll be like, well, how many properties did you look at? Well, you know, I looked at 3 or 4 of them and nothing worked out. I go, okay, so what did you do the other 23 hours in that day? Right? And it's just, really, is that, they'll spend more time looking at the menu for their dinner than they will at looking at investment properties that, you know, are going to make them tens of thousands of dollars. It's a very interesting phenomenon. But yes, it's like, yeah, you got to look at the beginning. It's hard, right? At the beginning, it's tough. You're not sure what you're doing. I joke with people now. It's like my first property, it took me a year to pull the trigger because I didn't know what I was doing. It wasn't a really good deal. I got bailed out by inflation. I made a couple of dollars, but it wasn't because I was good. It was because I was lucky. But now, just because you start getting good at it, it's like any other skill. You know, I can look at a property, and I know in 10 seconds if I'm interested in that property. I ask 3 questions, and I'll know after 3 questions if that's something I'm interested in.
Okay, and Bill. What are those 3 questions?
Well, what's my most important aspect? What do I care about? 2 things I told you.
Cash flow.
Cash flow is first. How much cash flow will it generate? That's actually question 2. First question is, how much of a discount am I buying the property for? That's the first question. Got to have a discount. How deep is that discount, right? Second thing is, with the discount, how much cash flow will that asset generate? If I allocate my money here, it means I can't go someplace else with it, so it's an opportunity lost. How much will that asset generate in cash flow? And then the third question is, if it makes it through the first 2, third question is there anything about this deal that I'm missing? Because it's obviously a spectacular deal. I'm buying the property at a huge discount. It's generating boatloads of cash flow. Am I missing something? Right? Am I the sucker in the room or the smartest guy in the room? And, you know, you could be buying a property that's in a flood zone, that has asbestos, that was a meth lab, that has lead poisoning or something. You know, there might be a reason why everyone else is staying away from that property. But I'll tell you what, most of the time there isn't. Most of the time, just because you know what you're doing, you are the smartest person in the room, and you got to be okay with that.
So you're saying, first of all, discount. How big a discount are you looking to get on a deal? 20%, 30%, 40%?
Oh, no. I want to buy properties for 20 to 30 cents on the dollar.
Wow.
That's my goal. And you know what? You say wow. Most people would say wow. But it's not, it happens every day. It's just we're not tuned into it. We don't think it does, so to us it's a big deal. I mean, think about it. When I told you about that house, the $70,000 house for 20 grand,
mm-hmm.
that was before I learned about tax deeds. Now I can buy a $70,000 house for 3 or 4 grand. That would seem impossible to most people. Right? If I was to ask a question to a group of investors and say, okay, I have a $70,000 house, how can I buy that house for $4,000?
So to get the discounts that you're looking for, what I hear you saying, you're looking at tax deeds. What other type of strategies would get you those kind of discounts? Tax
well,
deeds?
Well, a foreclosure.
Foreclosure.
Right?
Tax deed foreclosure.
An auction.
Auction.
Properties that are at auction, you'd be surprised. A lot of times they're at a deep discount. A lot of times they aren't, but you got to sort out the ones that are, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So tax deeds, foreclosures, auctions. You might find people that, this is, you know, an interesting thing. You might find a property on Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace. Again, not MLS, of people that might just want to retire and, you know, there might be a health issue and they might be just tired of the property and they might just want to move to Florida and be out of it. So their goal is not to get the most money out of the property. The goal might be, hey, I just want to get out of it this week. I have other things of higher priority.
So what I hear you saying is that you got to have a strategy, okay? If you're looking at discounts, the tax deeds, the foreclosures, and auctions, then you educate yourself in those areas, and you start looking at properties because then you'll know what a good deal is. So those are the three strategies to get the big discounts that you're looking for. What's the second thing? You said cash flow. What type of cap rate, which is what we talk about sometimes, what type of return are you looking to get in terms of the cash flow? What's the minimum?
In my world, if I'm not getting over 30% cash flow, I'm moving along. 30%. Now, here's the interesting thing. That used to be a big deal. Now, I have properties that get 40, 50, even 100% a year. And again, it's because you're constantly honing your craft. So I always ask investors, especially people that have been studying or whatever, what's a good cash flow? A lot of them will say 10%, something magical about 10%. And you know what? In a lot of cases, that might be good. But it's because they sort of have given up on doing better. Technically, you could buy a property where the seller actually pays you to take it. Right? So if you're getting a property where a seller is paying you to take it, your cap rate is infinity. Or if they give you the property for whatever reason, your cap rate is infinity. You don't see that in books.
So to let people understand what that means, so if you're looking at a 30% return, then that means that you bought a property for $10,000 and you're getting rents of $3,000 a month. Is that? I'm sorry,
no,
not $3,000.
You're getting rents.
$3,000 a year. $3,000 a year.
But you actually, I'm talking about net 30%. So you still have to make enough rent that you're paying your taxes, your insurance, your maintenance, all the other expenses if you have a property manager and everything else. I'm talking about netting 30% a year.
Wow.
So that's even a higher bar.
That's even a higher bar. And I'm assuming, because, you know, Felicia and I's strategy is a little different. You know, we're looking at properties under $35,000, okay? We're looking at properties that have tenants in them. And in this market, and we talked about this earlier today, Section 8, which, you know, hopefully we'll have you on again to talk a little bit about that. And then we're looking at properties that have already have tenants in them. So our strategy is under $35,000, looking at them with tenants in them, and preferably the tenants are Section 8, because then you get your money every month. You don't have to worry about chasing somebody down. And everybody, you know, that might be their strategy. And our cap rate is about 20%, you know, 15 to 20%. Uh-huh. And, you know, that's doing good. Now, eventually we're going to get to the point where we can do what you're doing, which is looking at foreclosures and tax deeds and auctions, because in those cases you don't have tenants in them, and, you know, that's a whole different strategy. So we're just kind of going a little bit, you know, kind of tiptoeing into it, and then start be a grown-up like you in real estate investing.
Yeah, but I love your idea. I love your model. Now think about it. When the crash just hit here with the coronavirus, Section 8 is absolutely golden, because people have lost their job. If they have a job in the service sector or the hospitality business, they can't make their payment. So if they're your tenant, you have a problem. But if you have somebody on Section 8, all of a sudden Section 8, the value of a Section 8 tenant has gone through the roof, because that's guaranteed money. Right? Those checks will always come from the government, the federal government, regardless of what's going on. So you can see how Section 8 just went to the top of the list as far as value. And I love your idea of buying properties that already have tenants in them. My goodness, if you've got a tenant in a property and they've taken care of it and they have a track record and you can buy the property instantly cash flowing with that tenant, I love that strategy. Why take a chance buying a vacant property that God knows who you're going to get in? You don't know if that tenant will be successful or not. So, yes,
And it does lower your risk in terms of if there's any problems with the property. You know, is electricity good?
Absolutely.
You know, are there any structural issues? Because you go in there and talk to the tenant, they're going to tell you, hey, it's a leak over here in the roof, you know.
Right.
Or, you know, the electricity doesn't work. Or, you know, we have a hole in the floor. Or the toilet doesn't work. And those kinds of things. Because they're going to tell you what the real deal is. And so that's kind of good.
And here's the thing. Here's you're creating value, right? Most people think, and this, if you go and talk to a tenant when you're going to buy a house, the tenant's like, oh, crap, my landlord is selling my house. I'm going to have to move. So they're thinking, oh, my God, this is a bad thing for me. But if you talk to the tenant and say, hey, would you like to stay here? And they're like, well, can I? It's like, oh, absolutely. I would love it if you'd stay here. Now they're on your side, right? Now you guys are partners in the effort. And you'll get better information, you'll get a happier tenant. But I would, you know, I'm always like, listen, if there's any way you can stay, let's make that work. Right?
Awesome.
And the question might be, would you like to eventually buy this place? It's like, are you kidding me? Now look, it's off in the future. We got to do some work. I got to make sure that you're, you know, a good tenant and everything. But yeah, I don't want to own this property forever. I would love to have a tenant that's going to eventually want to buy it.
And some of the properties that we've looked at that we didn't buy, but some of the properties that we looked at it is the tenants have been in there like 5-10 years.
Ah.
And back again, if you come to them and say, listen, you've been here 5 or 10 years, wouldn't you like to own this property? And they would jump at it. So we're going to be graduating to that strategy as well, is having tenants. And as you've already said, a tenant that is buying the property, they're going to take care of it, you know, a lot better than someone who's just renting it, you know, because eventually you're going to own it. And so we're going to have you come on and talk about that strategy. Well, we got about a minute or two left, Bill. Any parting word before I let you go?
Well, Yes, and I'm so glad you let me come on today. It's such an honor to be on the show. I just want everybody to start thinking about controlling their own financial destiny and not giving your money to somebody that you don't know who they are, hoping for the best. I mean, when you give your money to the Wall Street guys, they don't care about your future, folks. You know, but if you're building your own communities, if you're helping, if you're doing, you know, with these rental houses and creating value for others, that's how society was for years until Wall Street got involved. So,
and I tell people all the time, there's two ways to make money in America. I mean, where the rich make money. That's either owning a business or investing in real estate. And oftentimes, most of the times, 9 times out of 10, they're doing both.
Right.
You know.
That's
yeah.
true.
So, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Bill, for being on. Bill Omi, thank you so much for sharing with our listeners on how to buy real estate. We'll have to have you on to talk about some specific topics. We covered a lot of stuff today. I'm sure people are saying, wow, this is a lot of stuff. But perhaps later on we're going to select some specific topics that you can just kind of – we can kind of go a little bit deeper, and we use a lot of terms that probably people may not be familiar with. And so we'll come again. So thank you so much for being on, Bill.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Alrighty, take care now.
Okay,
all right.
Bye.
Yeah, he's a wealth of knowledge about real estate investing, you know, and you know, for me, for Bill has been Felicia and I's mentor in this process, and I never really had a mentor in anything actually. You know, I've had my own business, and Felicia's had her own business, but I've never had a mentor. And one of our criteria in dealing with Bill was say, hey, let me see what you've done. And so, you know, we went to the area that he buys real estate, and we talked to him, and you know, and we saw what he was doing. Because you don't want to have somebody being your mentor that, you know, is not doing what they want you to do. And in this process, this was like a 2-year process. We studied and looked at properties for 2 years before we bought our first property. And we're getting almost 20% on that property. Look at it like this. If you went to the bank and you put in $1,000, are they going to give you 20% on your money? No. You'll probably be lucky or fortunate enough to get 1%. And so, you know, my strategy is that, you know, you have to be able to learn. We're constantly looking at properties all the time. You know, because we like to see what good deals, and then we look at properties, and sometimes we're not ready to buy right now, and it gives you an idea of what the marketplace is. So we're in selecting, we're in like three. We're looking at three cities, one city that we're investing in, and there's two other cities that we're looking at, and that's where we're going. I have also the fortunate part is that when I tell people I'm a real estate investor, those people are curious. They're, well, what you doing? And I was sharing this with my nephew. And make a long story short, a week or two, about 3-4 weeks ago, well, about a month or two ago before the coronavirus stuff hit, he came down here and looked at the cities that we're investing, the city that we're investing properties in. He showed him our property, and he said, hey, I want in. And he put a bid on a property about 3 weeks ago that got accepted, and he's getting ready to close at the end of this month. And he's going to be getting about 20% on that property, too. He's a young guy. He's in his, I think he's probably in his late 40s, I think. So it's possible to do this. And the first thing is you got to get educated, number one. And then at some point, you're going to have to pull the trigger. And we were concerned. I mean, we were concerned, but, you know, we said, hey, this is something I want to do. We got bumps and bruises so far, you know. It's a good deal for us. We're looking to buy 3 more properties this year with our goal of buying about 20 to 25 properties, generating about $100,000 a year, and do that over the next 3 to 5 years. And then we can semi-retire, so to speak, and buy us an RV and travel around the country. Well, thank you so much for joining us. If you want more information about what we do, you can email me at charlesross@outlook.com. Charles Ross@outlook.com. Thank you so much for listening to our show. And have a good evening. And we'll see you again on Wednesday at 7 o'clock.